Today we're going to spend some more time on Exodus chapter 19. We looked last week in some depth at the first six or seven verses. Today we will be looking more or less at the perspective of the whole chapter. In contrasting the Mosaic law and grace, Pascal once said, "The law imposed what it did not give. Grace gives all that it imposes." We're in a section of the book of Exodus now where we will be seeing the revelation of the Mosaic law. It'll be given and received by the fledgling nation of Israel. In that context, Pascal's words are important to remember, for it would not be an accurate statement to think that because we are now moving into the dispensation of law, that God has in some way fundamentally changed the way he deals with mankind. In fact, from the beginning of the Bible, from the time that God first sought out Adam after Adam sinned, God has dealt with mankind on the basis of that grace that gives all that it imposes. In fact, grace is foundational to the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant underpins the relationship that God has with Israel. When God deals with fallen man, he always deals with fallen man on the basis of grace. If he does not deal with fallen man on the basis of grace, then law becomes fallen man's great enemy. Last week we looked at the beginning verses of this chapter. After Jethro's return home, the Israelites have left their camp at Rephidim, arrived in the wilderness, and they've camped in front of the mountain known as Sinai. Moses, in his writing, stresses the importance of this mountain to the history of the Jewish people. And it's no coincidence that Israel has arrived at this place, at this mountain, at exactly 2 months to the day from the day that they left Egypt in the Exodus. This no coincidence to the Jewish mind underscores a parallel that Moses is drawing here, which talks to the significance of the events that are about to occur. The parallel is between the exact day of the Exodus in parallel with the exact day of the arrival at Mount Sinai. Sinai was a goal for the Jewish people, and for Moses in particular, ever since chapter 3, verse 12. Because in his initial call to divine service, there God told Moses, "When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship the true God upon this mountain." When you have brought the people out of Egypt. How distant that fulfillment must have seemed to Moses at that time, if he even believed it at all. But now he's standing here at the mountain, and the Jewish nation is with him. And what God has promised, he has providentially brought to pass. And in doing so, he's demonstrated his faithfulness to his own word and his faithfulness to his servant Moses. At Mount Sinai, Moses will serve as an intercessor who will mediate God's revelation that seals the covenant between God and Israel. This is the time and the place where Israel officially becomes a covenant nation. A nation that God has set apart for the purpose of mediating his greater plan of salvation, the whole of the world. There's never been a nation other than Israel that was founded on God's moral law for the purpose of bringing God's redemptive plan to bear in the world. We have principles of the Judeo-Christian thinking and belief in our founding documents. But the intent of the founding of our country was different from the intent of the founding of Israel. I think at this time I'd like to take a moment and read through this chapter. I'll make a couple of comments as we go through, and then we will look at the chapter as a whole. Exodus 19, beginning with verse 1. "On the third new moon, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai, and they camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain." I want you to notice something beginning with this third verse. this chapter is really framed around, I'll talk about this in some detail in a moment, but just for now, it's framed around three ascents and descents by Moses up and down the mountain. The first account of the first ascent is in verse 3. But Moses went up to God, that is up the mountain, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell to the sons of Israel." And here are the words. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." And notice the conditional language of verse 5. "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples of the earth, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you will speak to the sons of Israel." So Moses came and he called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. This occurs at the bottom of the mountain. So verse 7 is then the first descent from the mountain. So now Moses is at the camp at the bottom of the mountain. Verse 8. "All the people answered together once they had heard these words, and they said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do.' And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord." That's the second ascending of the mountain. Verse 9. He's up the mountain. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud, in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever.' Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. The Lord also said to Moses, 'Go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments. And let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of the people. You shall set boundaries for the people all around, saying, 'Beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through.'" That would be with an arrow. "Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain." That would be up near it, but not on it. Now, so Moses went down. That's the second descent. Note, Moses went down from the mountain to the people, and he consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman." So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now, Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. There's the third ascent up the mountain. Verse 21. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down, warn the people so that they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people can't come up to the mountain because you've warned us, saying, 'Set boundaries about the mountain and consecrate it.'" Then the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, or he will break through against them." Here's the third descent. So Moses went down to the people, and he told them. So the stage is now set for the initiation of the covenant, which will be given beginning in chapter 20. The Israelites are in the place at the predetermined time where God will reveal his covenant to the people through Moses. Before the law will be given, a very significant event must occur. Israel must meet her God in person, at least to the degree that that's possible. Now, you may recall that we've talked in our study of Genesis, as well as sometimes in Exodus, something we call a theophany. A theophany is an occasion when God reveals himself in a tangible way to his people. In this case, before the theophany can occur, the people of Israel have to be consecrated in a ceremonial fashion. As far as the way the rest of this chapter rolls out, verses 3 through 15 mark the two-day period of preparation for this meeting that will take place on day 3. Verses 16 through 25, through the end of the chapter, give the final preparations that take place on the morning of the third day before God reveals himself to the people. When you read this, it's really hard not to be struck by what a serious matter it is for a man to meet God. There have been other theophanies in the book of Genesis. Most notably, Yahweh met with Abram, Genesis 15, Genesis 17, Genesis 18. Jacob had this wonderful experience on his way to Haran when he camped at Bethel, Genesis 28. But there's never been a time until this time when God met with an entire nation. You see, in the Old Testament, you can't just walk up to God and introduce yourself. It doesn't work that way. Last week I noted that because of Adam's sin, since that time, since the fall, all fellowship with God, all access to God has been a mediated access. Sin has the effect of separating man from his Creator. And nothing short of a complete consecration will prevent the meeting of that man with God from being a catastrophe. We have to keep something in mind. No ritual can change the character of fallen man. What takes place here, the washing of clothing, possibly the washing of hands, an imposed period of celibacy, these are all designed to symbolize this sin separation that exists between God and man and the need for a spiritual cleansing. Consider Abraham. He is a pattern to us for a man of faith. He is an illustration of how a man attains a right standing before God. A right standing before God is attained by grace through faith as a gift of God, not through ritual or ceremony. But requiring this period of preparation calls attention to, but does not remove, the fundamental spiritual divide that exists between fallen man and God. This is the problem that Jesus solved on the cross and was symbolized by the tearing away of the veil in the temple, which separated the Holy of Holies in the temple from the common areas. It symbolized the separation between God and a fallen race. As I mentioned, the preparation for the meeting is framed around Moses ascending and descending the mountain three times during this three-day period. There are two ascents and descents associated with the first 2 days of preparation. Then there's one ascent and a descent on the third day. Day three begins at the crack of dawn, at the morning, when Moses is called to the summit, where he will then receive the Book of the Covenant from God. So let's break this down by these three ascent-descent cycles and look at the first one, which covers verses 3 through 8. There really are a couple of questions that we should probably ask ourselves when we read this. The first is, what is the basis for the covenant that's about to be made? The second question is, what is Israel's motivation for accepting the Sinaitic covenant? So the first question is, what is the basis for the covenant, and upon what does the covenant rest? The basis for the covenant that God is about to establish with the people, with Israel, that thing upon which it will rest, is Israel's election. God's choice of Israel to be a holy nation and a kingdom of priests and a prized possession for himself doesn't originate at Sinai. God has already chosen Abraham. He's already called him years earlier, and he's made with him an unconditional covenant that carries through everything that happens at Sinai and afterwards. In other words, the covenant that God is about to make here with Israel does not abrogate the covenant that he made with Abraham. It continues to be in effect. So the Sinaitic covenant, this covenant that's about to be made, and even the Torah itself, are results of Israel's election, and they rest on the covenant of grace that God has already made with Abraham. The expectation, the expected response that Israel is to have to its election is obedience. And obedience occurs by being cognizant of and obeying the stipulations of the covenant. As a matter of fact, we are elected to something. Israel was chosen to be God's prized possession, God's kingdom of priests, God's holy nation. And in a similar fashion, if you read the words of Peter in his first epistle, chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, he states that Christians have been chosen by the sanctifying work of the Holy Spirit to obedience. In other words, we are chosen. Our election is for a purpose, and that purpose is to be obedient to God's word. When in the first part of this chapter, God used the word sigula, which is that word that means prized possession. When he used that word to describe Israel, it was a deliberate choice of a term that was widely known throughout the Middle East to mean a prized possession that belongs to the king. But it has another meaning also, because it's used primarily in covenant context to describe Israel as the object of divine choice. Through election, through that choice that God made of Israel, Israel is transformed. This people who were at one time a group of slaves in Egypt are now transformed into a kingdom of priests. In the same way that a priest mediates the blessings of God to those whom he serves, Israel's role will be that of a servant nation, a mediating nation, through which God will give to the world both his written word and the living word, the Messiah. Through Israel, the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant will be mediated. They will be made accessible to Gentile nations that otherwise would be excluded for fellowship with their Creator. Ideally, a chosen nation, a holy nation, will mirror the character of God, so that through the obedience of Israel and the uniqueness of Israel among the pagan nations, unbelievers will see in the face of Israel the face of Israel's God. So this is the intent of Israel's election, to be a conduit to bring salvation to the world. Does this sound like a demanding task? Heavy load? Great responsibility? Are you glad the duty fell to Israel and not to you? Well, not so fast. Let's think again about the words of Peter over in his first epistle, chapter 2. Listen to what he says in verses 9 and 10, and listen for the metaphors that he uses, and also listen for the number of times he uses the word you, because he's addressing here the church. He's addressing us. Here are his words. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you're the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. The church, by virtue of our election, possesses many blessings that are similar to the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant. But along with those blessings come a great deal of responsibility. In fact, Peter uses the same metaphors here to describe the purpose and duties of the Christian church that he used to refer to Israel. Like Israel, our election demands that in word and deed we reflect Christ in the world. And yet, inevitably, as Israel failed, we will fail to properly represent the character of Christ in the world. This brings us to the second question. The second question is, what is Israel's motivation for accepting the Sinaitic covenant? Who in the world would want to put themselves under that kind of pressure? Well, the motivation is really quite simple, and it's described clearly in this chapter. The motivation to accept the covenant is gratitude for what God has done for Israel. God delivered Israel from a life of slavery in Egypt. He sustained them through difficulties miraculously in the desert. Furthermore, Israel has seen with her own eyes God's salvation. He bore them up as on eagle's wings. They have seen God's justice. He judged their oppressors, the Egyptians. The faith that Israel is being asked to express through this covenant, Mount Sinai, only makes sense in the context of complete trust in Yahweh. And it's the tangible evidence of God's faithfulness. All of those things which Israel has seen with their own eyes that forms the basis for her faith. And it's in Israel's thankfulness and in God's salvation and His justice that leads Israel to accept by faith the covenant at Mount Sinai. Every difficulty Israel has faced has been an opportunity for God to prove His faithfulness to Israel. The covenant will give Israel the same opportunity to prove her faithfulness to Yahweh, an opportunity she will squander. The first descent and ascent cycle closes with Israel accepting the terms of the covenant, a covenant that they, unfortunately, like our Congress, had not read. They said, we'll do it. Whatever God says, that's what we'll do. It's easy to jump on this, and a lot of commentators have, and criticize Israel for biting off more than she can spiritually and morally chew. And there's no doubt that she's done just that. But as you think about this, though God's standards, without question, are absolute, and no man can ever attain to them, the idea that Israel would start off her covenant relationship with God by refusing fidelity to the covenant just seems absurd to me. So I think there's a great deal of good intentions here. And I think there's a bit of not understanding what they've chosen to do. But Israel accepts and binds themselves with these words to the covenant. Now Israel will have to live out the faith of Abraham as a unique holy nation, a kingdom of priests, the unique possession of Yahweh. This brings us to the second ascent-descent cycle, verses 9 through 15. There are two speeches that are associated with this second cycle. The first speech occurs in verse 9, and it describes the manner in which Yahweh will appear. He'll appear to all of Israel on day 3. His appearance will be phenomenological. That means that this theophany will be accompanied by great things like thunder and lightning. And most notably, Yahweh will be shrouded by a dense cloud, which will allow the people to hear His voice while preserving their lives under the principle that no man can see the face of God and live. There's a reason God's appearing before the people. He wants all of Israel to hear His conversation with Moses. This is not about proving to the people that God exists. They already know God exists. Think what they've seen in the plagues of Egypt and in the dividing of the sea and these things. This isn't about the credibility of whether God exists. This is about the credibility of Moses as their appointed leader. When the people see the cloud, when they hear the voice, they'll have tangible proof that Moses' role as mediator between God and the people is a role that has been assigned to him and carries the very authority of God. Without faith in the messenger, Israel will not put sufficient credence in the message. The second speech describes in general terms how Israel is to prepare for this meeting. There aren't really a lot of details that are given here, though I think we can assume that consecration, which by the way comes from the Hebrew word kadosh, which means to be holy or set apart. That's what it means to be consecrated. We can assume that this consecration, this process that's mentioned, verse 10, involves ritual cleansing, washing personal garments, probably some other ritualistic practices that would have been familiar to the nation of Israel. So I mentioned earlier, none of these things, none of these rituals exists as an end unto itself. They're not ways of attaining salvation or even spiritual purity. The process, this process they go through, by its very nature, is simply an acknowledgement of the moral and spiritual distance that exists separating the people from their God. That this moral and spiritual distance exists is further emphasized in verses 12 and 13, where boundaries are set around the mountain. In the same way that common man was not allowed to enter the Holy of Holies of the temple or to touch the Ark of the Covenant, in like manner, the mountain, because it's the place where God has chosen to reside, is forbidden ground. The death penalty is to be invoked against any man or beast who violates this holy ground, who trespasses on the mountain. And again, the reason for this is to emphasize the otherness of God and the fact that he cannot be approached apart from a mediator. Another specific restriction is mentioned in verse 15. Do not go near a woman. Every man on occasion could probably benefit from taking note of this advice, but this is not advice in the way we use the terms. In Jewish thought, sexual relations rendered a man ceremonially unclean, but not sinful. And that's an important distinction to make. And you can read Leviticus 15 and 1 Samuel 21 for more clarity on the subject. And then this brings us to the third ascent-descent cycle, which occurs on day 3. It begins at sunrise. As promised, God appears on the mountain. His appearance is accompanied by physical phenomena, thunder, lightning, dense cloud, the sound of the shofar, the ram's horn. These phenomena are accompanied further by earthquakes, by smoke and fire. The people who witness these things are struck with great fear, which would be a normal response to something of this magnitude. And it must have been quite amazing, because we're not told anyplace else in Exodus that the people were afraid when God divided the Red Sea. That's a pretty miraculous event, but we're not told anything about their fear. But here we're told that they were very afraid, and in fact, they trembled. In verses 20 through 23, Yahweh summons Moses once again to the summit, and he asks him to come there alone. So he returns to remind the people that there's this restriction about coming near the mountain. There's an unexpected reference to priests in chapter 22, which is interesting because the priesthood at this point in time has not been established for Israel. This may be some sort of informal designation for people among the Israelites who were performing certain priestly duties, but it may not be a formal use of the term priest. We know that the patriarchs acted as priests when they offered sacrifices on behalf of their families. So these priests may be the fathers, or they may be the firstborn among many of the clans of Israel. Nevertheless, it's significant that Aaron is mentioned in verse 24. So two verses later, Aaron's name is mentioned, which brings us to this third event that occurs. Yahweh instructs Moses to descend and to return to the mountain with Aaron. The fact that Aaron is singled out, brought into God's presence by Moses, sets the stage for the formation of the priesthood. It's the priests who will minister in the temple, and on the Day of Atonement, the high priest will be able to enter the Holy of Holies to sprinkle blood on the Ark of the Covenant. So this sort of is looking forward to that time. So we have now the scene set for the revelation of the Book of the Covenant. Because of its mediator, sometimes the Book of the Covenant is known as the Mosaic Covenant. Because of the place where it took place, Mount Sinai, sometimes it's called the Sinaitic Covenant. It would probably be more accurate to call it Yahweh's Covenant, because it was God who authored it. Just a couple of concluding remarks this morning. When we read about the Theophany, and we read about the fear which the people felt when they approached their God, it's easy to draw a correct conclusion that is also a wrong conclusion. Here's the correct conclusion. God is a fearful God, a God that sinful man cannot approach and live. This is true. There are many examples in the Bible of the reality of this. According to the Apostle Peter, we should fear God. He admonishes us to honor all the people, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king. But there's another way to tell the story, and it goes something like this. We're to fear God, and at the same time, we're to not fear him. Well, how does that work? We're to fear God by recognizing who he is. He is a God who is absolutely righteous, and his righteousness demands that he be a God of perfect justice. And therefore, as sinners, we have no approach to him. But the fact is, God has done what we could not do. He's approached us. God set aside the privileges of who he is, and he became a man like us. He lived a perfect life, and he did something no other man has ever done. He kept the law. As a man, he was able to represent mankind as an advocate. As God, he was able to offer a sacrifice that was infinite in value. As one who kept the law, he could stand as an advocate for lawbreakers. John could thus proclaim, "If any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous." As our mediator, we have access to God through him. Otherwise, God would not be approachable for us. Therefore, let us draw near, not run away from in fear, but draw near to the throne of grace, so that we may receive the mercy and grace as help in time of need. And through him, we have a legal standing with God under the new covenant, a covenant based on his blood that he shared for us, something that we celebrated this very day when we observe communion. As we continue now into the book of the covenant, which we'll begin next week in chapter 20, we're going to see, really through the end of this book, how all of these things point forward to the coming of Messiah. So we have now ready to have the covenant given to be initiated, and that's what we will start to do next week.